And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Tim Gautreau back to the program today. Tim is one of the most respected writers of short stories and novels in America. His novels are The Clearing, The Next Step in the Dance, and The Missing. He's had four short story collections, and the newest of which is called Signals, which includes new and selected stories. Now, Tim, how did you go about looking at all the stories you've written over the years and deciding which ones would make it into Signals?
That's a good question. I think I like to write broad-spectrum fiction. That is, fiction that can appeal to all social classes, educated people, blue-collar people. That's probably the criterion I chose to winnow out one story from another.
You have quite a few protagonists who are working-class folks.
Right. Well, I come from a working-class family, a blue-collar family. Everybody in my family was a railroad guy or a river guy, a machinist, blacksmith, whatever, go all the way back. They were in the mechanical trades. And everybody fixed their own stuff when I was a kid. Or they traded work with the neighbors down the street. So I sort of got my introduction into working on mechanisms quite early.
Do you ever have a bit of guilt growing up and going to college and sitting on your butt and working for a living?
No, not at all. But it's hard to get away from that business about working on objects. Whenever a lawnmower would break down for one of my other erudite acquaintances, they would, of course, go buy a new lawnmower or bring it to the lawnmower shop. I would get my wrenches out and take it apart and fix it myself.
And there's quite a bit of repair work that goes on in these stories, too.
That's right. That's right. And it's metaphorical as well as being actual.
Thinking back to when you first started writing short stories to now, has your approach when you go into writing one changed much?
No. Probably my approach changes with each story because each story has its unique requirements. Sometimes the plot will occur to me all at once. Sometimes not so much. You start basically with one sentence, and then you just have an organic development of the narrative that grows like a tomato plant or something, one sentence growing out of the other. So there are many different ways a story can form.
Have you ever sat down to write a short story in one of your novels where the result from that?
That's quite possible. I have some stories that beg to be evolved, continued. Welding with Children is one of them. Welding with Children is about a grandfather who takes care of a bunch of his daughter's illegitimate children. When it first came out, first, couple of years, I would get mail from high school students and even grammar. One group of letters from grammar school students in Texas that asked, well, what happened to Nunu? What happened to Freddie? You know, they were worried about these children that were in this story, and they were treating them like they were members of a news report rather than a piece of fiction.
Well, you gave so many of those kids distinct personalities in that very short story. And
right, I guess so.
Many of the stories are set in the Grand Crapo area of Louisiana. Where would it be if it existed?
If it existed, it would probably be a little bit west of Lafayette, Louisiana, somewhere off in the Canefield, Rice Field district.
Why did you call it Big Toad?
Big Toad. It sounds funny and grotesque, which is kind of what a lot of Louisiana is.
There are a handful of stories that take place outside of Louisiana. How did you get like a handle on blizzards in order to write The Furnace Man's Lament?
I moved away from Louisiana about a year and a half ago, and I kind of wondered what effect that would have on my fiction. So I said, let me start setting a few stories outside of Louisiana. And it was not a traumatic experience at all. I just wrote the same story, but it was relocated among a different tribe. And as far as how do I know to write about Minnesota, thank God for the internet. You know, it took a little research. I did some linguistic research. I had to research law regarding orphans in Minnesota and the weather, but all that's in either YouTube or Google, you know, and a 6,500-word construct like a short story. Of course, that story was very long. You can do that. I'm not sure I could handle setting a novel in Minnesota.
Where are you living now?
I live in Signal Mountain above Chattanooga. That's where my main place is, and then most summers we spend in a mountain house I have outside of Jefferson, North Carolina, which is right south of the Virginia line.
Now, you do have a character in the story review goes up to, is it Indiana?
Yes.
And complains mightily about the food. So how is it for you moving out of Louisiana, which is probably the best food in America.
Yeah. We just came back from 4 or 5 days in New Orleans, and we tried our best to eat our way through the entire city, and they're quite overstuffed as a result. But when I met a man from Lafayette in Chattanooga the other day, he says, "I'm thinking of moving up here." I said, "Oh, well, that's good." He says, "What do you do for seafood around here?" And I told him, "We buy magazines and look at pictures of it."
Now, a lot of your characters live in small towns, are working class. It seems like it's kind of like the perfect demographic for Trump support. You find the funny and the humaneness in these people, but you also do show a lot of bad choices, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody, whether you're a flaming liberal or a right-wing conservative, makes bad choices, and about equal amounts, to tell you the truth. It's curious you should mention that, because I just finished kind of a tour of the North. I was up in Pennsylvania doing a reading and a couple lectures for a university up there. And all I saw all through Pennsylvania was Trump signs. When we would stop in the restaurant, there were people talking about Trump. And we stopped at a Wendy's one day, and there was an old man in there proselytizing like a preacher about Donald Trump in the middle of the dining room. So, you know, the support is all over the place, not necessarily from me, but I didn't vote for either one of the leading candidates. I don't like to talk or think politically about literature. I think it's totally irrelevant. A lot of our people in college nowadays, our instructors, are very politicized, and they teach literature in a political way. I was not educated that way, so that's still foreign to me.
Now, you talked about evangelizing. You do have a couple stories that feature priests. Mm-hmm. And in their stories and in a couple of other stories, the old dictum of no good deed goes unpunished comes to the fore.
Yeah, there's no logic to the dispensing of grace by the Almighty. And this is something that Flannery O'Connor used as one of her main themes in her fiction. And, of course, like most Southern writers that were educated years ago, and probably a lot of contemporary writers, were always influenced one way or the other by Flannery O'Connor. You know, and it can't wash off. Once you've read all of Flannery O'Connor's fiction, you're sort of formed by it to a certain extent, because she does so many technical things that really work in the modern age, like the blending of humor and tragedy.
Easy pickings. Kind of seems like the best case scenario for a good man is hard to find.
Yeah, right. Well, the difference between me and O'Connor is there's a little more humor. I think I'm probably more realistic than O'Connor, because I'm 69 years old and no one has ever held me up. No one has ever stuck a knife in me. No one has ever left me asleep in a bowl of grits at the roadside diner. I began to think about that and think that, well, I'm just very lucky. Then I realized that the bad stuff that happens in America is really quite small, but it gets a lot of press. If a boy gets an Eagle Scout badge, you don't see that on the front page. But if somebody kills someone with a hatchet, with photos, you get it on the front page. We have a sort of curious old lady-like, you know, lust for bad news in this country. And that's one thing I think that spoils literature. Because you can write fantastic and interesting literature just about ordinary people, be they accountants or farm workers.
And in The Adventures of Sue Pistola and Good for the Soul and in Deputy Sid, you have these law enforcement figures who are doing their best to give people breaks, mm-hmm. and they just can't seem to take advantage of the mm-hmm. kindness that's been showed to them.
Yeah, well, Deputy Sid, if you read between the lines, succeeds in his quest toward liberalizing his particular character that he's dealing with, which is a sort of a mildly racist backcountry fellow in South Louisiana. But the jury's still out on The Adventures of Sue Pistola. Sue Pistola is a most recent story that deals with my fascination for people who self-destruct for no reason. They live in a prosperous country. They have all sorts of opportunities. They're not dumb, but they still make these decisions that are counter to their own well-being and that of their family. I think The Adventures of Sue Pistola might wind up to be my next novel.
There's quite a few stories that have working class parents whose children have kind of turned out to be no accounts.
Yeah, well, that comes from teaching 30 years, 33 years.
So you think the quality of students has gone down over the interim?
Well, yes, through no fault of their own, most of them. People that were made 300 years ago are still, you know, humans. They're like the people that were made yesterday, but they're not being raised the same way. The things they're exposed to are not the same things. The way they're educated is not the same way. So you almost say, well, it's not their fault, you know. But particularly when you get older and you see somebody who's underperforming in class, you sort of wonder how they were raised rather than how they were educated.
And there are a couple of stories like Welding with Children and What We Don't See in the Light, in which they're older men, they're reflecting back on their life, and they kind of see how they have screwed up their kids.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, when I would teach survey courses in literature, and I've said this, I've told this story a lot, what happens is you get a lot of unwed mothers with children, and some days their babysitters or their grandparents can't take care of the kids, so they meet you outside of class and they say, can I bring my kids to school? And I say, sure, bring them in, because it's, you know, survey course. And we don't really cover anything that's going to hurt the kids. So they'll show up and they'll be like, you know, the regular 35 student load in a, say, a American literature course. I can remember times when I would ask the class questions and the only hands up I would get would be an 8-year-old on the first row trying to answer the questions and sometimes getting it right.
There's a story, Resistance, in which an older man, retired man with his wife has passed, tries to help out a neighborhood girl whose father is just a no account. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of instances in the stories in which it's not no good deed goes unpunished, but there's not quite the level of gratitude they were looking for from the people they help. And so it kind of betrays their motivations for helping in the first place, was to get something for themselves.
I don't think that character wanted really something for himself. This is one of my stories where a character arrives at a point where he has to make a decision. And that decision will define him. And it will also indicate where the story's going. So Mr. Boudreau knows this little girl next door wants to do a science project, but her drunkard father won't help her and her mother can't. And he knows this, and he goes out on the lawn one day and picks up his paper, and the little girl is sitting on her front steps next door in a blue funk, and he starts to talk to her. He's standing on his front steps banging a newspaper on his leg, and you know what he's thinking. He says, go inside, don't get involved, don't do this. But instead, he turns to the girl, and he says, let me talk to your mama. And at that point, he's made a decision, and that changes both the character and defines him. And it also dictates where the entire story is going for the rest of the 6,000, 7,000 words.
And it's a bit different in that one because you're talking about characters who self-destruct in Su Pistola, that her father is self-destructing, but he's determined to bring everyone else down with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And Sue is a little bit more, she doesn't have children, so she's not inclined to drag them down to her level.
Yeah. The original question probably related to Mr. Boudreau the most, because at the end of the story, she doesn't thank him for going through a heck of a lot of trouble to help her with the science project. But anybody that's a parent knows that that's just kids. They don't thank their parents very often, at least not for 30 years after they graduate high school.
You talked about humor in Flannery O'Connor, and in the story Attitude Adjustment, we have a priest who's been in a horrible automobile accident, was hit by a train,
right,
and then just a series of events that make his life worse and worse. He ends up spending a couple of years in the pen. And if you were just to tell someone the occurrences of the story, you'd go, that's terrible, but it's hilarious.
Yeah, well, you've got to know how to blend humor. First of all, it's a very dark story. On the surface, the priest gets in this terrible accident, and he used to be a good preacher, and he can't preach well anymore. He has brain damage that's gradually correcting itself. But, you can't write stories like that that are dark and have the reader just be depressed. People will stop reading them, and nobody will buy a collection of stories that is all doom and gloom. Making a story is sort of like making a good gumbo. You have to know what ingredients to put in it. And if you put in a little humor, it's a, you know, it's kind of a leavening agent, right? It kind of brings things up a little bit. And the hard thing is figuring out how to blend in humor with the tragedy, you know, how to take the Greek tragedy template and apply it to modern fiction, the mixture of humor and tragedy. And that's why that story works all the way up to the end, you know. I won't give the ending away, but he's teaching a little Sunday school, basically, a Catholic version of Sunday school, with a bunch of little kids. And it's so sad, but it's so touching at the same time. And funny, especially the last line.
And so he's telling stories, and early on he's trying to deliver the homilies, and he's telling stories from the Bible, and his interpretations of them are wildly different from what conventional thought would be.
Right.
And then later we have the story Died and Gone to Vegas, which is a story about people sitting around telling stories to each other.
Yeah.
When you're writing a story, how do you then decide what kind of story gets told by other people inside that story?
Well, each story has its own electrical schematic, and each story is different. Sometimes they're like Died and Gone to Vegas is like 90%, 95% humor, a frontier type humor, a rough humor. But the one we were just talking about, the priest story, attitude adjustment, there's just sort of millivolts of humor running through it. It depends on how you use your language. If your language is surprising enough, the reader will be delighted with it instead of depressed by it. So, and it's hard to explain how to do that or what that is. But a lot of it has to do with my training in poetry, where we were supposed to take each line seriously and cut the ones that didn't work or didn't contribute. And so you trained like that, you tend to write a story like a poem with economy, with, you know, no irrelevance.
Does that make writing novels a little bit more difficult?
Yes, because you tend to be really careful sentence by sentence with your novel. Now, a novel does have a bit more room in it to bang around, but it has less allowances for mistakes, because if you write an irrelevant chapter and include an irrelevant character and you realize that this is really hurting the overall 305,000-word manuscript, you've got to go back and rewrite, and that could take 6 months. If you make a mistake like that in a story, you just cut a scene or shift it to the back or change the gender of the narrator or something, and that'll fix it.
Now, in Died and Gone to Vegas, you have people telling all these stories. Did you create these stories out of whole cloth, or are they stories you remember from growing up?
My brother's a storyteller. He's an 80-year-old oil man who lives in Fort Worth, and many of those stories came from things he would tell me when he came back out of the Gulf. When he was young, he was cementer for Halliburton on the offshore oil rigs. People passed the time out there, particularly a long time ago, the same way people in town pass them, by having, you know, bull sessions and things like that in the kitchen or the lunchroom, the galley, they call it. And I often thought, you know, this particular story about the guy in the bathroom when the rig exploded could be made into a story. Nah, nobody would believe that. And then, you know, the one about the guy who had the tree fall on his trailer because he bought a Mercedes, nobody would believe that. So what I did one day is I assembled a list on a piece of paper of all the stories that would not work in fiction and would not support a whole narrative. And I put them all together in one story. And Died and Gone to Vegas was in Atlantic, and it was reprinted in several university anthologies, and it's being taught a lot in the universities of the country. So it worked.
Well, what were you trying to achieve with the story?
The ennobling of the American tall tale, which is still alive, or can be still alive, because all of these Bouret stories, they're playing Bouret, are lies, probably, or elaborate embellishments. If you look into the story, you'll see that the name of the boat that they're on is an old dredge boat called the R.C. Canterbury. And so these are the Canterbury tales. They're all saying, like, well, this is the way somebody tried to be happy and it failed. This guy tried to steal a shotgun and wound up in prison. This guy tried to give his girlfriend a big diamond ring and he wound up getting arrested for grave robbery. These people are on some kind of a quest in each story, and they all fail. One of the characters has a fantasy about the cook, who is a big woman who won the pot with a bunch of money in it at the end of the story. And he says, what's she going to do with that money? You know, she's going to go to Vegas and she's going to get thrown out of a casino for being a lout, and she's going to lose all her money. She's probably going to cash in her plane ticket and wind up hitchhiking back to Louisiana. But this is his fantasy of what's going to happen to this woman, and the reader sort of nods, yeah, that's probably what's going to happen. And so everybody except one character, I won't go into him, is a failure in all of those stories. If you look at it, they all want something that is visceral and of this world and immediate. And whereas the true pilgrim to Canterbury was looking for something that had a vaguely spiritual nature to it. And so if your life has no spiritual goals, this is kind of where you wind up, in the desert.
What kind of card game is Bouray?
Bouray is, it's sort of like the old game of whist. It's a trick-taking game. Everybody's given five cards, and if you take a trick, you can stay in the pot. If you take three tricks, you can win the pot. Bouray rules vary from household to household in Louisiana, but the pots can roll over and get quite big. Some people play an anti-Bouray, where you just put up a certain amount of money with each hand, and some people play pot Bouray, where if there's $50 in the pot and you Bouray, you have to match the pot. Well, Bouray means you don't take any tricks. So if you choose to play that particular hand, you better be sure of winning at least one trick, like you carry in an ace or a king. You probably take a trick.
Kind of like going nil in spades.
Yeah, right.
Do you see a lessening of regional character in America?
That's a good question. It depends on whose region you're talking about. You know, there's so little fiction we have access to nowadays. You can go to a store and you can buy a collection of stories, but you don't know what you're going to get. Or you can read a New Yorker story. Everything else seems to be segregated into these little state-supported things like the Maryland Review, the Southern Review in Baton Rouge, the Georgia Review. Every state has its own little review. So fiction is not as accessible as it used to be. GQ doesn't print fiction anymore. You know, the women's magazines don't print fiction. Esquire doesn't print fiction. You know, and I could go on and on and on.
We're talking on the radio right now. And there's not a whole lot of technology in your stories, but radio does play a big role in a couple of the stories. What is it about that medium that interests you?
Well, any mechanism interests me. I don't want to get too far away from your question, but like right now, I spend a lot of time volunteering as a machinist at the Chattanooga Railroad Museum in Chattanooga. I'm also a qualified locomotive fireman, so I can shovel 3 tons of coal during a 9-hour shift. Keeps me in shape. I'll take apart anything that needs repairing. You know, if your grandchild comes up to you and says, my bicycle chain fell off, you got to take the back wheel off, blah, 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 and fix it. You don't bring it to the bicycle shop and pay $200 for somebody to put the chain back on. Could you rephrase your question?
What is it about radio that fascinates you that you...
Well, I used to be a 500-watt radio announcer, and I had to deal with some pretty obsolete machinery there. When you're an announcer, you learn about frequencies and where the radio waves go and how far they go. And I know one station I used to work for was always wandering off its signal. We'd get complaints from Biloxi or Jackson, like, hey, you're stepping on our signal, you know, to recalibrate.
And did y'all have to power down at sundown?
Yeah, we had to power down at sundown, right. That was back in the old days. But also, I like to listen to music. And the best sound I can get is with 70s-era speakers that have been renovated a little bit. And these old high-end audio sets like Pioneer audio receivers, you get what they call a deep canyon sound. You know, it's a different sound than contemporary stuff. Because I bought a $1,000 system or something, and to me, it's after listening to old Pioneer sets, it sounds like it cost 50 cents at Kmart. And it's also all blackface stuff. And you don't have the rotary switches. You don't have the big switches. You don't have the big screen that you can roll an indicator bar across. It's hard to see what you're doing with all of that equipment. It's terrible equipment. And it also is very limiting because you can nurse a weak signal along with an old set made in the early 70s. You can't do that with modern equipment.
And digital tuning.
Right, and digital tuning. Basically tells you what you can and cannot listen to.
We had an engineer here who built his own amps, and you would have to buy 2 amps to listen to a stereo signal.
Right. That's right. It's great stuff. Also know how to work on that stuff, because the components in the early 70s stuff are big, and an amateur can work on them.
In the title story, Signals, There's an Eastern European professor who loves his Pioneer receiver so, so very much. And he kind of struck me as like the worst case scenario for Andrei Codrescu.
Right. Yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah. Here's a person who is an intellectual who is totally self-absorbed, so much so that he values ideas more than people, particularly his wife. And we see why if you read that story.
He gets it pretty hard in that story. But there's another story called The Review where amateur novelist gets a small contract, puts out a book that's met with mediocre success, but one-star review on Amazon drives him insane. And the person who gives it to him is a professor at a community college up in Indiana. You manage to give him a lot of heart and humanity in the process.
Yeah, yeah. It was a hard story to write. Well, yeah, it was kind of hard to write because I brought the character along to a certain point, and I said, well, what is the point of the whole narrative? And so I had to come up with the ending, which I'm not going to talk about, which unites everything, brings everything together.
But it was nice to know that someone could work in a community college and not be completely bitter for no reason whatsoever.
Yes. Yeah. And you see why he's human and you feel for him at the end, the guy that writes the terrible review. Well, you know, you read Amazon and you see these reviews in there. For example, the two big insults in there, I forget the second one, but the first one is, this is out of the review. It says, oh boy, what tree died for this book? And which I can't imagine, you know, a nastier comment. You know, how do you react to something like that if you have thin skin? And this is a very thin-skinned guy. And he decides to get in his car and drive to Indiana and find the guy who wrote the Amazon review.
So how many hundreds of good reviews does it take to make up for a bad review?
I've been very lucky. I haven't received many bad reviews. And most of them are, you know, sort of accidents. I had one guy complain because I read the audiobook myself, but I didn't read the audiobook myself, so I don't know what he was talking about. He gave me one star, I think, on the audiobook.
Now, Deputy Sid pops up in a couple of stories. Has he been in other stories that weren't included in the collection?
Those are the only two I have Deputy Sid in. But Deputy Sid is a heavy hitter for me, and he could show up in something in the future. And he's based on what really happened. I mean, that story has a lot of real occurrences in it. Some people have accused me of making some kind of cliche out of Deputy Sid, but that was the guy I had, you know, when I was in his patrol car looking for my truck. And somebody stole my truck.
Oh, so how many of your stories do start off with a kernel of truth, like someone stealing your truck?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'd have to run an audit or something to see, but probably a number of them. There's a story that was not in the collection, for example, about a kind of ne'er-do-well guy that lives in New Orleans, and he's always working shucks to try to get money off of people, and his uncle hates him because he knows he's a crook. And he gets the idea of selling roof pigeons in the Times-Picayune for $20 a pop, saying that they were homing pigeons. He makes up a list of ludicrous instructions that he sells with each pigeon, and they're instructions on how to train the pigeon to come back to your house. Of course, pigeons never come back to anybody's house, but if you realize how silly you've been after you've made this purchase and you never go back and complain. So he's got this racket going, selling roof rats, as he calls them, for big money that he gets free out of his uncle's carport. I was listening to WWL many, many, many years ago, wondering what I was going to write for my next story. And Bob Ruby, who had a program in those days on WWL, it was extremely popular. Everybody listened to it. He had a topic for the day, and the topic for that day was mean tricks that you have played on someone. And a guy who had bought one of these pigeons called in and told the whole story. And I said, good God, this is the entire plot right here. All I have to do is flesh it out.
There's a story, Radio Magic, in which a guy buys an old console radio and hears tapes of a comedian from the 1940s played off some island in the Pacific. Is there any basis in truth on that one?
Just a technical basis in truth. You can have an old tube set rewired so that certain sections of the band will draw more powerfully than others, and that's about it. It sounds almost like magical realism. The reader might think, oh, well, an old radio can't really do this, but an old radio can. When I asked my father, when I went off to college in 1965 for a radio, instead of buying me a new radio, he gave me an old Crosley Fiver out of his workshop, which was 40 years old when I got it. I found out that by taking the antenna wire and hooking it to the screen outside my window late at night, I could bring in China, Canadian opera, France, Nova Scotia, because these signals would bounce off the ionosphere and come back down. Sometimes they would last 20 seconds. Sometimes they would last a half hour. But it was like free travel around the world.
Was that on the shortwave frequencies?
Yeah. And there's not much on shortwave anymore, but there are a lot of foreign countries that still broadcast in shortwave, but nothing much in America. If you go on the old police band, occasionally you'll hear airline conversations between pilots and towers. The old radios had all sorts of bands, like marine band. Marine band, you hear lots of cussing. Pilots trying to line up a boat, you know, and running interference with other boats. Even today, you can still find fascinating international conversation if you're patient to listen for it.
Now that you live in Chattanooga, and there are all sorts of hills and mountains over that way, is that a difference looking out your window and not seeing the horizon there in front of you like you would down in Louisiana?
Yeah, the mountains are beautiful. The people are very nice up there. The cuisine leaves something to be desired. But you can still find good meat and threes and good barbecue joints. We have another house outside of Jefferson, North Carolina. And, of course, the cuisine up there is actually better because the barbecue is so much better. You know, you can kill yourself with ribs and pork barbecue just as quick as you can kill it with oysters in New Orleans.
So you prefer the whole hog and the vinegar?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you got to have vinegar-based barbecue with a little red pepper in it.
Well, is a new novel in the works at all?
At this point, no, but I'm sure I'll run out of money sometime and need one. So there's a story in my collection called The Adventures of Soupy Stola, which sort of ends in medias res instead of beginning in medias res, you know, in the middle of the action. So that generally is a little suggestion that this should be continued. It would be easy to turn that story into a novel. The short story could be the first chapter.
Now, that's one of two stories in the collection that have a female protagonist. More difficult for you to write across gender?
That's an interesting question. It all depends on the nature of the narrative. If the narrative demands a female, I'll make the narrator or the main character a female. If it demands otherwise, it'll be male. The reason I say that is I try to write the piano tuner from the point of view of a woman, a female piano tuner. There are female piano tuners. It just wouldn't work, and I couldn't sell a story. So I just changed the gender. So, well, let me try this, you know. And I changed the gender back to a middle-aged man, and it made all the difference in the world. And I sold the story.
Well, and in that story, in the first story in the collection, Idols, you have people that are holding on to these formerly stately homes in the South, and they're falling down or around them. So that seems to be an idea that you like to investigate in your stories, too. Decline of the Old South.
I don't really care much about, you know, the aristocrats of the Old South, being from a blue-collar background myself. People in Louisiana don't care much about aristocracy unless you're deluded and live in Orleans Parish. And they sure don't care a whole lot about the Civil War. New Orleans surrendered before it was attacked in the Civil War. But that story is about, you know, again, trying to fix something. In this case, it was a big old house, but it was also about delusions of living in a big old house like that. There's a kind of humor ingrained underneath the narrative because everybody that knows anything about house repair knows that this guy's quest from the get-go is totally impossible and is going to end in some kind of disaster. I once was walking down St. Charles Avenue, and there was this enormous white house that looked like a wedding cake. It was so fancy. And there was a crew painting it with scaffolding and everything. And I saw an older gentleman standing right at the edge of the walk. I said, "Do you live here?" He said, "Yes, this is my house." I said, "Oh, it's very beautiful." He said, "Thank you." And this was like 20 years ago. I said, "How much, if you don't mind my asking, does it cost to paint a house like this?" He says, "Well, $35,000.
Ooh, goodness.
So that shows you what this character was up against, just to paint his place.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you so much for taking a few minutes out and talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Tim Gautreau is the author of Signals, New and Selected Stories, which is published by Knopf. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.